ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The world right now is a disaster. It's easy to feel helpless. But there was a moment when millions of people around the world said enough. I'm Sisson Kim Simong. Join me for Boycott, the fight to end apartheid, how Australians joined others around the world to push back against racism and won.
Whites-only teams, we thought that to the average Australian, that would be despicable.
Boycott, the fight to end apartheid. Search for ABC Rewind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Democrats in the US are chasing the religious vote. Will they bag enough believers to challenge Donald Trump later this year? This is the Religion and Ethics Report. Andrew West on ABC Radio National, ABC Listen, and across the Pacific on Radio Australia. That story is soon. After the Bondi massacre, state and federal governments passed hate speech laws. It's part of an effort to build social cohesion in a country scarred by recent anti-Semitism and other religious hatred. But does banning phrases such as "from the river to the sea," usually a reference to a Palestinian state, promote cohesion? Can any law mandate unity? Kieran Hardy is a criminologist at Griffith University and co-author of a new paper on the issue.
On the face of it, they're addressing very real threats around hate crime and extremism in society and the potential for that to fuel more serious acts of violence as well. In Queensland, there are the two specific phrases that are banned, and we've seen one person be arrested on the day of those laws came into effect. In Queensland, we have very specific phrases, whereas most of the time in hate crime laws, we've seen more sort of offences around serious intimidation or harassment and so on, what we call vilification.
And this was a woman who was wearing a T-shirt that said, "from the river to the sea."
I'd also seen a young man as well be arrested. So we'll sort of monitor over the coming days and weeks what happens with these laws. The laws certainly risk constitutional challenge, but striking down laws in Australia on the grounds of, say, freedom of speech is particularly difficult to do. More likely, there might be some amendments to the laws if the controversy around them becomes significant enough that, say, the next government changes them, or that seems to me a more likely outcome.
Now, these laws, even as imperfect as you point out, they're obviously a very understandable desire to instill social cohesion. I mean, that's something that you and Professor Rebecca Wicks write about in your recent article, and we'll put a link to it. I mean, the Prime Minister has called for social cohesion on, I think, 35 times. Can it be conjured out of law, though, Kieran? That's the point, social cohesion.
Yeah, and like you say, as a starting point, there's very good reason for these laws. You know, we are dealing with very serious threats of extremism in society across all sorts of different ideologies. We've got conspiracy thinking and right-wing extremism in addition to your sort of more traditional ISIS and Al-Qaeda-style ideologies. So the idea of trying to keep the temperature down on public debate, protests, all that kind of thing, makes a lot of sense as just that starting point. But we are now at the point that I suppose that there's a bit of an irony or contradiction in saying we're trying to build or improve social cohesion or enhance social cohesion through laws that punish people for saying certain things in society. So it's a bit of a conundrum. We do have a real problem to deal with. I'm just not convinced that laws and coercive laws are the best way to go about that, especially if they're seen as clamping down on freedom of speech.
As you've said, you're not an absolutist on this, but I wonder what some of the foundations of social cohesion are that it is hard to implement in law.
When we talk about social cohesion, it's more positive things like trust and markers of a good society, generally speaking, you know, social mobility, might be health, education, all these sorts of things that feed into it. Putting a few people in prison for hate crime offences is not really going to build social cohesion. There might be some logic to the idea that, well, if we take out a few bad apples out of the mix, we might have, you know, a better environment in which to create social cohesion. There might be some logic there, and I can understand that. But we really are talking about dealing with some threats to social cohesion in a pretty blunt way, when social cohesion really means much more wide-ranging positive things about society, like how do we help young people get the best opportunities later in life? How do we build a healthy democracy? All those sorts of things. And a new criminal offence for somebody harassing someone or saying these specific words is not going to build social cohesion according to the sorts of markets that we talk about.
I hasten to add, I mean, you're not opposing laws that actually take dangerous people who've committed violent offences off the streets. You're not opposing those laws. But it does strike me there's something in this article that you wrote where you said, we're not simply talking about the absence of conflict, as critically important as the absence of conflict is, but the presence of social bonds and shared norms. I gather laws are impossible to make to ensure those sorts of things.
That definition was from a recent paper by Biddle and Gray at the Australian National University, saying when we talk about social cohesion, we're not just saying the absence of conflict. So you can take the bad apples out and you can address these threats, but we're taking out deficits or addressing threats, but we're not putting anything into credit. And I don't think laws can put something positive like trust, social relationships, social bonds into credit, into the sort of positive column talking about social cohesion. You could say that these laws might impact on some measures of trust and inclusion if people say, oh, the governments are taking really decisive action on this. We're protecting our healthy society and that gives us a strong sense of our democracy. There may well be some effect like that. I would just say that I think given the controversy over the laws already, the way that they were rushed through Parliament, particularly over the Christmas break in response to the Monday terror attack, there's been sufficient reason to think that these laws have actually raised the temperature of a lot of public debate. They're a bit of a blunt instrument rushed through. There's a political benefit and there may well be some social benefit in governments taking decisive action on this. But to build social cohesion, we're really talking about longer term efforts to build a healthy society. And again, I'm not saying that punishing people for the sort of threats that they pose and the harm they pose is a bad thing. Maybe these laws go a little bit too far in targeting freedom of speech and that will cause more problems. We do already have a wide range of criminal offences for terrorism and all sorts of other problematic conduct. So it's not like we're wanting for laws that could punish people. Adding more laws that will punish people for even broader things around speech may do more harm than good.
I do have to ask though, Kieran, isn't there a case for these laws as in setting a red line in public discourse? You've crossed a line here. It is the very definition of extremism. Is there not a case for that?
I think there is a case for that. Say the Queensland laws, when you start targeting specific phrases, it starts getting quite problematic. I mean, I could go out in public and say all sorts of vile things about a group in society and not necessarily breach the law. But if I happen to say these specific words, and it's not for me to say how offensive those words are, I think there's been very strong views either way. But if I go say all sorts of vile things about a group, I might not be guilty of a criminal offence, but if I say these particular words, I am. That red line argument is already muddy because it's not necessarily clear where that line is or that there's a definite logic to it. Those arguments can be made, and I do understand them, but I think maybe these particular laws that we've got aren't necessarily the best way to go about that.
Yeah, in your article, you and Rebecca Wicks also point out this question of socioeconomic factors and the whole notion of socioeconomic factors and social cohesion has come up as people try to understand the story of populism and why it has such an appeal. What are these socioeconomic factors that you think are being overlooked?
If you think just generally about the sort of environment that everyone's in at the moment, we talk about a cost of living crisis, housing costs, all sorts of pressures that people are under. Now, it's difficult in a research sense to draw direct lines between the economic insecurity people might be facing and one particular act of violence. So we mentioned the concept of relative deprivation. That's been seen as quite important to acts of violence and political violence. There's a grievance about some people who have more in society. And despite all the effort that I'm putting in, I can't get there. We know that there are certain groups, sovereign citizens and others, where, say, financial difficulties, home difficulties, marriage and relationship difficulties are highly present in samples of people who believe in some of these more extreme ideas that can fuel things at the moment. When people are put under strain, various different strains, economic strains, personal relationship strains, all of that can then feed into criminal behaviour and other things. So it's hard to draw a direct line in individual cases, but we do know that economic insecurity, fragility sort of contributes to antisocial behaviour overall.
And the rural and regional divide here in trying to understand this appeal.
It's hard to sort of generalise about the types of threats. We probably could talk about a whole range of specific things in the field of extremism. We can talk about sort of neo-Nazi groups, we can talk about sovereign citizens. So it's hard to generalize across those groups in a short space of time. But say I just mentioned sovereign citizens before, there's some really good research coming out around sort of regional rural inequalities and the sorts of factors that can feed into that. We know that people are doing it tough in a range of different fields, and in some cases, certainly not all cases. And that's the problem with this. You don't want to overgeneralize to the point of saying, well, anybody facing these sorts of difficulties will go down any particular path. But we just know that overall in society, it's not as healthy a place if we have things like economic insecurity, regional rural inequalities. And they're the sorts of things that if government addressed, another big one would be mental health and health and hospital access in regional and rural communities. There are so many things the government could fix and invest more money into that would boost social cohesion more than trying to say, let's stamp out this type of extremism or that type of extremism. Address those sorts of root underlying causes of disharmony in society, and that would be a much better strategy than trying to target a few people under new criminal laws.
Kieran Hardy, he's a criminologist at Griffith University with his colleague Rebecca Wicks. He's written a piece about the challenges of social cohesion. We'll put a link to that at our website. Thanks for joining us on the program, Kieran.
Thanks very much for having me.
This is the Religion and Ethics Report on ABC Radio National. Democrats in the US are making a major pitch to win religious votes. Even with a growing secularism, America still has a solid Christian majority. For 40 years, Democrats have struggled to win their trust. But ahead of congressional elections in November, several white Protestant clergy have decided to run as Democratic candidates. Professor David Smith of the US Studies Center at Sydney University has been following the races.
85% of white evangelical voters voted for Donald Trump in 2024. 55% of Catholic voters voted for Donald Trump in 2024. So the two biggest blocks of Christian voters in the United States, you have clear majorities, in some cases very large majorities, now habitually voting Republican. And that was not always the case. If you go back to the early 1970s, you would find plenty of conservative Catholics and evangelical Protestants voting for the Democratic Party. But that shift that has taken place since then means that especially in rural areas of the United States, in the Deep South, in parts of the Midwest, Democrats often start from this position where it's nearly impossible for them to win in some districts because so many Christian voters vote for the Republican Party.
Yeah. If I recall correctly, now the numbers are fairly small, but didn't Barack Obama win something like 22, 23% of white evangelical votes?
Yes, he did. And he won states like Iowa and Indiana. He was certainly able to make inroads there. That was also, I think, to do with the fact that so many white Christian voters were so exhausted by the George W. Bush presidency and were really ready for something new. But certainly Democrats haven't had a candidate like that for a long time who has been able to cross over into those areas of heartland America. And I still think about the similarities in some ways between Obama and Trump in terms of the way that they campaigned. Both of them loved holding mass rallies in rural parts of America, in rural parts of swing states. And Democrats just haven't really seen a candidate like that since then. But Barack Obama, another thing that he had in common with Trump was a very constructive message. It was a message that the government is there to do something for you. Yes, he made promises which no president could ever really hope to fulfill, but so did Donald Trump. There's really a role there for candidates who come with very bold messages about what they can actually do for the American people.
Yeah. Okay. So let's look at some of the ways that on the ground at a grassroots level, Democrats may be trying to rectify this. There is quite a few, and this is a very important distinction, white Protestants who are seeking Democratic nomination. Why is it significant that it's white Protestants?
That is significant because there have been many black Protestant clergy on the Democratic side of politics for a very long time. You only have to look currently at Senator Reverend Raphael Warnock from Georgia, who is actually from Martin Luther King's church, or the late Jesse Jackson, who was also from that black Christian civil rights tradition. People are very used to seeing people like them and Emmanuel Cleaver from Missouri, black Protestant pastors in many cases, really bringing a kind of Christian left message into the legislature. But it is very unusual to see that among white clergy. I think that nearly all of the white clergy currently in the United States Congress are on the Republican side. Seeing white Democratic clergy, white Democratic Protestant clergy, that would be something quite new.
Yeah, the most obvious example of this in recent days has been the victory in the Democratic primary in Texas for the Senate of James Tallarico. What makes him so interesting? Some controversies have come up since, but we'll talk about those. But at first glance, what makes James Tallarico so interesting and potentially compelling as a Democratic candidate?
What he's really got going for him is that he's running as an economic populist backed by a scriptural message. He's taking all of the kind of left-wing populism that you can out of the scriptures. He regularly references Jesus overturning the tables of the moneylenders in the temples. He's saying that the Bible phrase that should be visible in all schools is money is the root of all evil. He's taking all of those messages from the Bible and transforming it into this economic populist message. Even though the media often said that he was the moderate in his primary race against Jasmine Crockett, actually the economic message that he was offering was a lot more radical than hers. And progressives in Texas really got behind him. They weren't happy about Jasmine Crockett being supported by the crypto industry. Tallarico was really saying in economic terms things that a lot of people want to hear right now, which is you are struggling because of the fact that the wealthy elite in this country is forcing you to struggle. He's really doing that backed by a scriptural message. That's what makes him so promising to so many people.
Will that economic populism be enough, though, to overcome Tallarico's probably quite controversial positions that, despite his strong identification with faith, others have pointed out he's finding it hard to break away from modern democratic orthodoxies on things like gender and sexuality and abortion? Is that a potential problem for him?
It's not that he can't break free from democratic orthodoxy. He actually embraces that from a Christian left position, probably more vigorously than most Democrats do. These are really the conclusions that he has come to based on his own understanding of faith. And that's not unusual for people who come from these very liberal Christian traditions. Tallarico knows it is a political liability for him that he's identified with comments like God is non-binary, even though these are things that he believes in very deeply. The approach that he's taking is essentially to say that culture wars are irrelevant to most people. Prices, not pronouns, was the term that he's used. So he wants to take the focus off culture war issues, because there is no way he is ever going to distance himself from them, because this is what he really believes. What he is hoping is that he can try to refocus everything towards the economy. And if there's ever a year when that might work, it's possibly this year. The only thing that really would make it possible for him to win in Texas is if Republicans choose not incumbent Senator John Cornyn in their primaries, but Ken Paxton, who's an extremely controversial attorney general in Texas. Not only is he very far right, he has had scandals that most other politicians would never survive, but he has managed to survive both financial and sexual scandals. He does have a chance of winning the Republican primary. If he wins, then polls suggest that Tallarico's got a chance, but yeah, it would still be a long shot.
Yeah, I just wonder, you know, what sort of turbulence James Tallarico, the now Democratic candidate for Senate in Texas, will hit when they start going to his church in Austin, Texas, where they find it hard to use the phrases father and Lord. Not sure how they say the Lord's Prayer in the church, but it is that kind of church that may be open to being targeted for, you know, a kind of extreme liberal identity. And I'm not sure how well that goes down in the Texas heartland.
It probably won't go down very well with a lot of voters. But another thing that could work in Tallarico's favour is that people trust clergy in general. Part of Tallarico's identity is it's not just the specific theological positions that he has. It's the idea that I am a man of conviction. And I think that this is one of the potential strengths of these clergy who are running for these positions. Even if they believe in a theology that is quite different from what ordinary people believe in their districts, they at least have the language and the kind of conceptual vocabulary for connecting with Americans in a way that a lot of other liberals don't have. There are certainly many ways to construct a liberal morality or a left morality, but the potential Christian basis to constructing that morality is an underrated one. It's one that Jesse Jackson really knew how to mobilize. I kept thinking about this after Jesse Jackson's death. In his famous recitation, "I am somebody," one of the things that always really gets me in that is, "I am God's child." Just the very simple idea that all human beings have dignity and all human beings are equal because they are God's children, and no matter who they are somebody. Within the United States, I think that is one of the most powerful ways there is of constructing a political philosophy based around the struggles of the poor. It's potentially a lot more successful than other routes that liberals or populists have to it. The appeal of Christianity goes beyond just specific theological positions. It's about being able to explain liberal politics or left-wing politics in terms that really resonate with people of faith.
Yeah, this reminds me, David, of one of the very first conversations we had on this program with you in 2012 about the language of faith. This is the Religion and Ethics Report here on ABC Radio National. I'm speaking with Professor David Smith of the University of Sydney at the US Studies Centre. Just on the point about Jesse Jackson, there's an interesting trajectory, though, that's gone on the religious left, because when Jesse Jackson died, I was reminded in my reading, Jesse Jackson had for most of his career been pro-life. In 1980, a very strong denunciation of abortion. And that had actually been the position of many civil rights leaders, many black Christian leaders on the left, going all the way back to Fannie Lou Hamer at the Democratic Convention, I think, of 1964. That's an interesting change on the Democratic religious left.
It is. Certainly, he also had a very strong anti-drug message as well, which would also be probably somewhat out of place today. There have been some interesting changes that have taken place in African American Christianity over the last 30 years or so. All kinds of changes around abortion and sexuality. Jesse Jackson was ahead of the curve in terms of welcoming gay and lesbian people into his coalition, but as you say, very anti-abortion.
Let's broaden this, David, because beyond some of these culture war questions, I notice that a number of these white Protestant clergy who are now seeking to run in the election as Democrats are doing so because they fear the rise of Christian nationalism. Now, I know that culture wars are part of that, but there seems to be a bigger pushback here. What's that about?
A lot of them are worried about the future of Christianity in a country where Christianity is associated with the kind of Christian nationalism being promoted by Republican figures. And they've got very good reason to be worried. Robert Putnam and David Campbell warned in their book, American Grace, back in 2010, that if Christianity as a whole became too closely associated with one side of politics, then younger people in particular would start to turn away from Christianity altogether because of the fact that they associated it with that side of politics. The more that Christian nationalism really becomes a very prominent part of this equation, I think that a lot of Christian clergy are alarmed about the very future of Christianity in the United States, that it will no longer be Christianity, that it will just be a kind of spiritual arm of a political movement. That is what they are really pushing back against. When we look at the rise of people in the United States who no longer identify with a religion, not many of them are committed atheists. Many of them are still open to religious belief, but there's basically a huge number of ex-Christians in there, or people who might have grown up Christian but never seriously committed to it. That group, which is getting increasingly large, it's now above 20% of the population of the United States, that's a group that these liberal Christians could be potentially appealing to. Even a lot of conservative-minded Christians are quite uncomfortable with the kind of tenets of Christianity that increasingly seem to elevate the nation or their understanding of the nation above Christianity itself, that really seem to make Christianity subordinate to the flag, essentially. So that's what they're pushing back against.
Yeah, that's fascinating, David. I mean, that's the story, for example, of this Christian pastor, Rob Reyes. He was actually running in previous elections as a Republican. He never unseated a sitting Republican. He's now running as a Democrat, very centrist fellow. But again, the story is the corruption, as he sees it, of Christianity by politics and this mixture of the two. Just before we go, on the Catholic vote, what opportunities are there for Democrats to claw back enough of the Catholic vote for it to make a difference? We know that Pope Leo is seen in many quarters as a different type of American voice on the global stage. I wonder whether that's enough to make a change to the Catholic vote in America, given that you're talking only about 3 or 4%. That needs to switch over?
This is a really interesting question, and I think we'll have to wait for the elections to actually see how that plays out. Americans, Catholics politically, don't always listen very closely to the Catholic clergy, except on the issue of abortion, where they really do seem to follow the clergy. But on issues where Catholics in other countries would also take their cues from the clergy, everything from immigration to nuclear weapons, American Catholics don't follow the clergy that closely. It might be different having an American pope, a pope from Chicago. This is such an extraordinarily unprecedented situation. It's hard to say how it will play out politically. And I was reading today about this very difficult balance that Pope Leo is trying to achieve, where he has said he doesn't want the Catholic Church to be contributing to polarization in the United States, which means even when he makes quite forceful political statements, he has to be quite careful about the way that he does it, because he just doesn't want to contribute any further to this atmosphere of polarization that he sees as very destructive. I haven't seen very much so far on the Catholic side about Democrats really trying to take advantage of this situation, but I suppose we'll see in the coming elections how it plays out.
Yeah, and worth remembering that there have been two Catholic clergy elected to the U.S. House of Representatives, elected to the Congress, both Democrats and both quite liberal, at a time, of course, when being liberal meant something different. Professor David Smith of the U.S. Studies Centre at the University of Sydney. David, thanks for coming back to the program.
My pleasure, as always.
That's it for this episode. Follow us at ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to Sinead Lee and Harvey O'Sullivan. I'm Andrew West. Join us again for the Religion and Ethics Report.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.